We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
We're back and we have a great guest in the house with us, Dr. Tom Palmer. He joins us to discuss socialism, fascism, or market capitalism. A moral and pragmatic comparison, which is going to be the topic that he will discuss on a speaker series that will be presented tonight at Isidore Newman School at 6 o'clock. The program begins at 6:15. If you have an interest in going out, it's at the Henson Auditorium at 5333 Deniel Street. It's sponsored by Metairie Park Country Day School and Isidore Newman School. Excuse me, it's not my namesake. And it's supported by Greg Rusevich, who joins us in the studio as well, and the Jay LaPere families. This is their 10th year of sponsoring this series of speakers. Is that correct?
Yeah, next year will next be our 10-year anniversary. This is 9 years.
This is their 9th year. Yep. And actually, I've been to one or two of them, and you guys always have incredible speakers come in. And I did some research and watched a number of your YouTube videos and your a number of different things that you presented. You are Executive Vice President for the International Programs at the Atlas Network, as well as a Senior Fellow at the Cato Institute. And Dr. Tom Palmer, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Noel. It's a pleasure to be here with you and to visit New Orleans.
Well, you know, it's an appropriate conversation because in light of any number of Democratic candidates that are out there talking about any number of different platforms, and they're talking democratic socialism as though that's a lot different than a lot of other things. And I love the way you put this, a moral and pragmatic comparison of what are the economic principles and what are we actually talking about in the presentation of what they're actually saying out there.
Well, if you think about market capitalism as a kind of one form of organization that is substantially realized in the United States, although imperfectly, other countries as well have market capitalism. It means that the economy is organized on the lines of property rights and voluntary exchange. And then the coordination that emerges comes about through the price system that is the result of all of those exchanges. Prices, these numbers guide us as to how to allocate resources, what is the real cost of doing things. The socialist approach is to say, well, that is irrational. It needs to have a plan. It's, as Karl Marx said, it's the anarchy of capitalism. We need to plan it, and we'll plan it so it'll be more fair, more just, and more rational. And so we will override the decisions of people about how they want to spend resources or allocate capital or their own household budgets, and instead these things will be provided by the state.
Well, it seems just at the most basic level that has a squelching effect on entrepreneurial spirit in many respects, does it not?
Well, that's the point, actually. Entrepreneurship is inherently unpredictable and unplannable. New things pop up. Who would have thought about all the material goods that we have today, the inventions and so on? But the socialist mentality says, no, we're going to plan these things rationally. We'll be able to plan out our own future. And in the Marxist version, they argued it was a higher form of freedom. The bourgeois freedom was you running your own life and making plans for your life and your family. That there would be instead the freedom of the whole society to realize its future. In effect, there'll be no more surprises, which means no more entrepreneurship. We will plan the future and in that way realize a higher freedom. One of the consequences when these people got into power was they were willing to eliminate and murder anyone in their way because what they were fighting for, as they saw it, was a higher freedom. And so as Lenin and others argued, when you eliminated all of those people, liquidated them, nothing was really lost. Nothing was lost when they were sent to the gulag and so on because a higher freedom, the freedom of humanity to plan its own future, was at stake. As we learned, this is a fantasy. It's not possible. If we knew what we would know in the future, it means we already know it now. It's incoherent, as Sir Karl Popper pointed out in his great criticism of socialism. The market system, recognizing the limited nature of human knowledge, all of us are limited beings, we need a process, a system to winnow out, to discover those new innovations that will make life better. And we have a system for finding the innovations that work. We call it profit. And loss is the way that we find out the innovations that didn't work. You lose money as a consequence. And so that is a winnowing system that can lead societies to higher degrees of entrepreneurial discovery and betterment for all of mankind. I'm not an inventor, an entrepreneur, a genius, and so on, but I benefit from all the wonderful people in society who are, who make computers and airplanes and new vaccines and medical treatments and now new gene treatments that they can identify for just your form of cancer. This is unleashed by the dynamic of the market capitalist process, and no socialist system can come anywhere near that in terms of bettering human life.
There seems to be this belief that under this notion of putting an adjective in front of socialism, democratic socialism, that this notion of income disparity is going to go away.
Yes, it's a kind of a fantasy. It's purely aspirational. But if you look at real existing socialism, so I spent a fair amount of time in the Soviet Union and the German Democratic Republic and in other communist countries back when we had that evil empire, the inequality between party members and elites and non-party members was stunning. It was absolutely amazing that the material well-being they enjoyed compared to the average person. One of the reasons those systems collapsed was when the elite, the top of the society, realized, because they were the ones who could travel and so on, the intelligence officers and top elites, when they began to travel to the West and realized, here I am a powerful, wealthy person in my society, and my standard of living is lower than that of a German plumber. That's when the system really collapsed, because even the rulers, they lost any sense of moral legitimacy. This was all a lie. So they had privileges that the average person couldn't get, access to medicine. They didn't have to wait in lines. They had dachas in the country. They had drivers. They had all these things. But the quality of those goods was so shoddy and terrible in comparison to what people of very humble means were able to afford in capitalist countries. That, I think, is one of the real reasons for the collapse of socialism.
In a number of your presentations, and when we come back, I want to get down to this about the notion of ingenuity, what that ultimately means based on the economic principles of comparing socialism to market capitalism, and then in moving this to a morality issue, and what's that all about? Is that just to kind of diffuse, in my view, the frailties of what they're really proposing for us to buy into, of trying to put this on a moral plane, and what that means to us as the constituents, and what are we actually voting for when they say free education for all, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, health care for all and everything else from an economic standpoint, and how we're going to ultimately finance it. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. We're with Dr. Tom Palmer. This is Newell on WWL. We're back with Dr. Tom Palmer, Executive Vice President for the International Programs at the Atlas Network, as well as a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and he's here as a speaker with Metairie Park Country Day School and Isidore Newman School on a speaker series supported by the Rusevich and Jay and LaPere families. They will have this is their ninth year tonight at Isidore Newman School at 6:15. You can be there at 6 p.m. Henson Auditorium, 5333 Deniel Street. Dr. Tom Palmer. The topic is Socialism, Fascism, or Market Capitalism, a Moral and Pragmatic Comparison. And when we're talking about that moral and pragmatic comparison, it seems as though a lot of folks are putting this on this moral plane, this moral landscape now, that, you have this moral obligation to do certain things. And we're dealing with poverty in a big way in this country right now. We're dealing with homelessness and things of that nature, immigration. And when I look at other countries, many of which are facing these same issues, some who are socialist countries, they're addressing it and addressing the issues in very similar ways to we are, and are suffering the same ills that we are, and coming to the same conclusions that we are, that these are problems that you're not going to buy your way out of it with them. There has to be some personal accountability that folks have to stand up and take stock of their own life at some point in time.
Well, I think one of the elements in this is that business enterprise, free enterprise, commerce has been given a very bad name by intellectuals for a long time. And they view it as immoral or dirty. And I think that's a pretty standard view among, the intellectual class by and large. Michael Sandel is professor at Harvard, very well-spoken, articulate person. His book, The Moral Limits of Markets, attacks exchange on the market. He has one throwaway line. Says, well, it's true, it's raised people out of poverty. So, well, okay, I think that counts for something really important. For him, it's just a throwaway. One of the things that's so striking, he says, monetary exchange spoils the good being bought. So everything involved in commerce becomes dirty. Business people are dirty, in his view. This really goes back to the whole anti-Semitic trope that Karl Marx articulated, that the market is about worshiping money. And indeed, anti-capitalism and anti-Semitism are very intimately connected ideologies that come. You see this over and over. Hatred of the Jews, hatred of commerce are intertwined. What we need to do is to understand that being involved in business is a noble calling. If you are an honest business person, you're creating value. You get profits, and those profits are a small sliver of the total value that you create for employees, for shareholders, for investors, for suppliers, and of course, most importantly, for your customers, for the consumers of the products that you produce. So that you are creating shared value, and the entrepreneur does get a piece of that, but a tiny sliver of the total value that is created. If you think about Bill Gates, he's a very rich man, $55, $56 billion. But he brought computational power onto the desktops of people all over the planet. Billions of people have benefited from that and are able to get, you know, radiology online and medical services.
Well, he changed the world.
It totally changed the world. And he's rich, and you know, that doesn't bother me.
I'm happy for him.
I'm happy for him. Now, he and his wife have decided that money will be spent to try to better the position of people who are not well off. No one can consume $55 billion in a lifetime.
But that's his choice, right?
That's a choice that they make to leave a lasting impression on the world. Many people in business do that. So, but making money is not an inherently dirty or wrong or bad thing. If you do it honestly by creating value, people should applaud those who are successful in business. But unfortunately, most intellectuals today do not. They consider it filthy and dirty and look up to someone like Senator Sanders, who looks down on business people and considers them all to be crooks and dishonest. And this simply is a false picture of the world. There's another element when you mention the morality that I think is very disturbing in American political culture today and in Europe. There's a hyper-polarization, and I think both sides really bear some responsibility for this. The idea that if you disagree with me, you're a bad person. And if you're a bad person, why should I listen to you?
Right.
You're a bad person. And we see that on both sides of the aisle. And what is needed is to have a civil conversation that doesn't focus on intentions. I prefer to assume other people have good intentions when they disagree with me and not infer bad intentions from a disagreement. And then be open and ask the question, well, how would I know that you're right, or how would I know that I'm wrong? What kind of evidence could we look to? When you go out and look at the actual performance of systems of state-dominated economy or state planning, they never perform according to what people promise. Every time they fail, what happens is an interesting psychological response is that people say, well, that wasn't really socialism. They're very enthusiastic at the time. It collapses into failure, and they say, well, it really wasn't. It was Stalinism, Maoism. Venezuela is a perfect example. Bernie Sanders just hired David Sirota as his senior policy advisor and speechwriter. David Sirota wrote a piece in Salon magazine, which you can find online at salon.com, Hugo Chavez's economic miracle. And he says it's fantastic what is happening in Venezuela. It's a model for the world. It shows what is possible. Well, really? We have seen now what is happening. One of the highest per capita income countries in Latin America, at one time the richest, now has generated the world's largest refugee problem, bigger than Syria, as people are fleeing out of the country trying to find food. It's a malevolent, violent dictatorship. It has created real famine, hunger, and want. There's not medicine in the hospitals. They don't have electricity. It's a whole society melting before our eyes. And the response is, well, next time we'll get it right.
Yeah.
That wasn't really socialism. But just one more chance, please.
So, you know, when we think about it and we put it on the moral plane and we're talking about and what the candidates are saying, and I get the text all the time, you're conflating the issue. You're talking about socialism, not democratic socialism. So what do you see as any distinguishing factors in trying to draw that distinction?
It's an important topic to discuss in an honest and fair way. So Friedrich Hayek in 1944 wrote The Road to Serfdom, and he argued that central planning of the economy was the road to slavery or serfdom. The argument was very tightly argued. It's quite readable today, and I encourage people, socialists, to pick it up and think about it. It's dedicated to socialists of all parties. He wasn't a hateful person. He had been a socialist. Mm-hmm. And when he realized it wouldn't work, he said it was a terrible day in his life. Because all the dreams he had, he realized, couldn't be realized. And he argues that when you centrally plan, as we saw in Venezuela, for example, the state now allocates newsprint. Is newsprint going to go to the opposition press? Oh, surprise, it doesn't.
No. Yeah.
So it eliminates that. Now, some people say, no, we want a democratic system, socialism, but it'll be democratically organized. And my first question is, can you point to any examples? When they say, well, Scandinavia, those are market economies.
Let's talk about that when we come back. We'll be right back with Dr. Tom Palmer. Socialism, fascism, or market capitalism? A moral and pragmatic comparison. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're back, and we're talking to Dr. Tom Palmer, Executive Vice President for the International Programs at the Atlas Network and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He will be presenting this evening at the Isidore Newman School in the Henson Auditorium at 5333 Daniil Street at 6 p.m. It's open to the public. You're welcome to come out. I've seen his presentation, some of his presentations online. Very, very interesting. One of the things, and we were just talking off air, and I'll bring it up because I think it's a good conversation. Pete Buttigieg, the mayor from South Bend, Indiana, running for president, talked about the Citizens United case, which really talked about corporate donations to political candidates, thought that was a problem, really kind of talked about one of the issues about the dangers of big corporations is that it equates money to power and power to influence in government. And you have an interesting observation about that and kind of a twist on that.
Well, I think he's asking the right questions. Why is it that some people have disproportionate influence? And we do see cronyism and corruption. There's no question about that. I don't associate those with the market economy. I associate those with big government. And so the way I put it, in my kitchen, if I leave food out on the counter, I'm going to get mice and bugs. That's the way the world is.
In New Orleans, it's roaches.
Yeah, okay. Well, I just say bugs generally. I just said yours are big enough you could put a leash on them.
Right.
but you're going to get bugs and mice. If you don't want bugs and mice, don't put out cookies and leave food on the counter in your kitchen and wash your dishes. What we have is a political system that leaves a bunch of food out on the counter. They're called subsidies and favors and grants of privilege that can go to this business or that business. When you do that, people will come and lobby for them. The solution, if you don't want that, is to have the rule of law. one law for everybody, not a special law for you if you lobby for it, and a different one for me, a tax code that I can come and get my lobbyist to make a little hole just big enough for me to go through, but not you. That's why we have such a complex tax code. All the lobbyists are there trying to get some special angle for their companies, for their clients. A simple tax code that said, you know, you made $100, the tax is 28%, send in $28. Rather than, oh, but if you did this and solar that and so on, you'll get all these different credits. That is like a dirty counter to a bunch of roaches. And the lobbyists swarm over those things. So we have so many ways in which government is used to benefit one person at the expense of another. And when you have that, people will come and lobby to get those benefits. We shouldn't be surprised. Look at the sugar subsidy program. I know that there are some people in Louisiana who benefit from it and in Florida, but it costs every other American a lot. We pay twice the price for sugar in this country because of the sugar quotas and the restrictions on cane sugar coming in from Brazil and the Caribbean, and it destroyed the candy industry in America. Turned out, big surprise, sugar is a major ingredient in candy. No one knew. But the consequence when these programs put in was that candy industries were effectively decimated by them. So one group benefited, but at the cost of the whole population and all the other firms for which sugar was an input. Now multiply that by thousands. All the different special subsidies and handouts and giveaways that government has, why should we be surprised that people swarm over Washington to lobby for those things?
Yeah, you know, and once again, you have this overgeneralization that all of a sudden, as you put it, the whole market capitalism economy is the one that's under attack, as though that's what generated this whole situation. There are some good corporate citizens to the economy that don't engage in that type of conduct and don't engage in that type of activity.
But more importantly, they're not the only generators of it. Politicians create these programs in order to get support from people. So whether it's from broad groups of population or their buddies or friends or companies that will support them. So it's not just the case that the politicians are all little Bo Peep, pure, innocent creatures, and wicked, bad businessmen comes and corrupts them. That does happen. But it's also the politicians coming to the businesses and saying, hey, it's a nice business you got there. Shame if something were to happen to it. You don't want to have that happen, do you? And so the power of the regulatory state or the administrative state and all the subsidies and so on gives the political class the ability to extort resources from the rest of society, and they do.
In one of your presentations, you talk about the typical supply and demand, but you also talk about it in the political context.
Not only a supply of political power, there is a demand for it as well. One form is I go in, I say, you know, I want you to put my competitor out of business. So I want to have a governmental power. And that happens all the time. People go and lobby to put their competitors out of business. The competitor goes out and prices go up for the customers when you get some kind of monopoly privilege created by government. So that's common. Then there's also a more general philosophy that I think needs to be combated. And I wrote a book on it called Self-Control or State Control, which is the view that people have that they shouldn't regulate their own behavior, that we need a government to tell us what we should eat and how to eat and to protect us from all of the pitfalls of life and the risks out there. The consequence of that is people become more and more dependent on the state. And I'm a little old-fashioned in the sense that I think that people need to learn personal responsibility. And I say this not as someone who's always good at it. I make mistakes and screw up.
Yeah.
But I'm constantly trying, as are other people out there, to say, how can I lead a better life rather than abdicate my responsibilities to government or someone else?
You know, one of the incredible examples of that is you go and you open a menu now in a restaurant that has more than, I think, 20-person capacity, and all of the menu items have how many calories are in that item.
I actually find that useful myself in some cases because when you're fighting the battle of the bulge,
right? Yeah,
you have to tell all the younger listeners when you hit about 25, you better start your little bit of lifestyle change. It's useful information out there that I find useful, but I don't need to have a governmental bureau telling me what I can't, that sodas over a certain size are illegal in
right.
New York. Mayor
New York,
Bloomberg
right.
was going to wage war on the Big Gulp and so on. Those are matters that people should be able to decide for themselves. And we should be focusing more on helping people to make responsible choices freely rather than dictating to them what choices will be allowed.
We'll be right back after the break with Dr. Tom Palmer talking about socialism, fascism, or market capitalism, a moral and pragmatic comparison. When we return, this is Newell on WWL. We're back, and we're talking to Dr. Tom Palmer, Executive Vice President with the Atlas Network and Senior Fellow at Cato Institute. So when we talk about this pragmatic comparison, so, you know, to the listening audience out there that's hearing all of these policy initiatives that a lot of the Democratic candidates are putting forward, and I use that term loosely because I'm not sure that these are really well thought out, you know, policy initiatives that they're talking about. It's more like just kind of ideas. But when they're talking about this, you know, Elizabeth Warren saying that, you know, we can get rid of college debt and, you know, we can just put a 2% tax on those that make $50 million or more and it'll rid us of this problem in perpetuity. That's new math that I don't understand quite so much yet. But what should they consider? What should they really look at when we're thinking about the economic realities of all of these ideas? I mean, if you were to give them the Cliff Note version, so to speak, of what is it that they should keep in the back of mind when they're looking at this?
I think the key word is incentives. What incentives have you created? So people say, we're going to create this program, and it'll have these wonderful outcomes because that's what we want. So let's set aside the outcomes. We assume you're a nice person, you want things to work out well. How will people behave in response to the incentives that you have created? And think about it from that perspective, because people will always game whatever system they're in. It's because we're clever creatures. We work out problems. And people usually do try to pursue their understanding of their self-interest, which doesn't mean selfishness. It could be for your family, your community, your neighborhood, and so on. So how will people respond to those incentives? And the fantasy of politics, which we find all across the political spectrum, is somehow people will respond to my aspirations, to what I think they should do, rather than responding to the incentives that they face. And let me mention, just to be equal opportunity, President Trump's comments on trade are just astonishing. First off, they're so ill-informed. He doesn't understand international trade. He keeps saying a trade deficit is the same as a loss in business. That's not true.
No, it's not true.
A trade deficit is equal to a capital account surplus on the accounting side. It means that people are investing in your country. There's nothing inherently scary about that. But he says, no, no, we're going to have more exports and we're going to be richer. And the way I'm going to do it is by taxing imports. It turns out when you tax imports, it has in the aggregate the same impact as taxing your exports because people are buying your exports with their imports. So it's not just one side of the political spectrum that gets it wrong. President Trump is, in a way, the mirror image of Senator Warren, which is to say, if I say this will have good outcomes, just pay attention to what I say. My view is, let's look at the incentives that it creates and how people will respond to it. That's where we should be focusing our attention. And once you do that, you get a much more realistic view of what public policies can accomplish.
One of the things that you said, that responsibility changes behavior.
Oh, absolutely. When you put in a situation where I'm not responsible for the results of my behavior, I'll do all kinds of things that might be very harmful to other people. Property rights, for instance, a lot of people don't understand the importance of property. It makes people responsible. You're responsible for the upkeep of this property. You have an incentive, the capital value of your house.
Right.
Imagine if you can only live in your house as long as you live, but you can't leave it to anyone or sell it. Everyone would run their housing stock down. Houses would look terrible as a consequence, a bit like public housing, for example, does.
Yeah, but no skin in the game. Right?
No skin in the game. That's really one of the keys. There's a new book by Nassim Nicholas Taleb called Skin in the Game that is about this question. So when you have skin in the game, it changes your behavior entirely. The difference between renting and owning. Most people understand renters treat property a little bit different from owners because they don't have that long-term investment.
We'll be right back. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL. On a text line says, I wish your guest would enter the presidential race. There you go, Dr. Tom Palmer. There's still time. Final thoughts.
Well, actually, thinking about property and why that's so important, and many people think that we could dispense with it and have the state run everything. Going back to Aristotle, he pointed out property makes us responsible. And the politics, he said, that which is common to the greatest number has the least care bestowed upon it. Everyone thinks of his own and hardly all of the common interest. And that's what we see in places where they don't have property. Lots of pollution, lots of filth. It's when people have property rights that they're responsible for taking care of the environment. That's what market economies bring. People concerned about the environment, I think, should be robustly, enthusiastically in favor of the market economy.
I have really enjoyed this interview. Thank you so much for joining us today. And the project that the Rusevich family and the LePere family, great job really exposing the students to this. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.